Subject is imparting character. Imparting character. This is the third in a series of three on of this kind. Imparting vision was the first one. Imparting ministry skills was the second one. And then the third one here is imparting character. A while ago, Walt Hendrickson and I were conversing about some of the needs in the navigators. And he was observing that one of our greatest needs was to learn how to build convictions in the men and women that we're working with. And he illustrated it this way. He said, now, you meet a fellow and he's in the Marines. And go into his barrack, and everything is immaculate. You know, his bunk is immaculate. You can bounce a coin on it. Your locker his locker is immaculate. And all of his gear is in order. Everything is shined. Everything is in its place. Then he says, you go back and visit the same guy a year later. And you go into his room, and this time it's a dormitory. And he says, and it looked like an explosion in a department store or something. You know, there's stuff all over the place. You can barely see where the bed is. And you know, there are beer cans and remains of pizzas from days gone by. And, you know, everything all over the place. And he says, now, what happened? It's not that he doesn't know how to keep things in order, because he proved that he knows how. But now, why is it that the same person can be one way in one situation and so much another way in another situation? And so we discussed that a little bit and concluded that it had something to do with motivation, that he isn't motivated in the second situation to keep his gear in order. So that's the problem. It's kind of like Holt's testimony, you know. You're going good for a while in a situation, but then you get out and where is the motivation to continue? Well, we're getting down to the subject of character, aren't we? Someone defined character as what you do in the dark. Look at Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5, verses 3 and 4 says, not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance, proven character, and proven character, hope, and our hope does not disappoint us because we have the Holy Spirit. And so you have a circle here. It starts out with hope in the beginning, verse 2, we exult in the hope of the glory of God, and this hope, you get into the hope of the glory of God, you enter the family of God, and you're going to run into tribulations. Well, then those tribulations are going to produce something else. What is it? Experience. Or perseverance. And perseverance produces proven character. Proven character goes on and produces hope. And so it's a circle. Well, the fact is that what this points out is that these experiences, and not very enjoyable ones, distressing experiences, tribulations, produce, in the end, the character. And so it's not just a matter of knowledge, knowing why, or knowing how. But somehow or other, there has got to be experience if we're going to be people of character. Now, it's funny because everybody has experiences. We all go through experiences every day. But the fact is that not everybody learns from his experiences. And that's the difference. Some people learn from their experiences and some don't. And so these experiences have got to be linked with something else. And in Hebrews 5:14, it says, strong meat belongs to those who are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern good and evil. Now it's talking about the use of the Scriptures. And so it says, a mature person is one who, by using the Scriptures, and he has enough latitude, enough room, so that he can experiment and discover what is good and evil for him. what works for him and what doesn't work for him. And so you find that maybe we can draw a formula. Character is the result or the product of experiences plus Scripture. And this is what produces character. Now, if you take one without the other, you have nothing. If you take character, or if you take experiences alone, like I said, you can have experiences all your life, but it doesn't really change your character. Or if you take just the Scriptures, and if all you do is soak your mind in the Scriptures, that does not guarantee that you're going to have Christian character. You know that you can graduate from a seminary with honors and be the honor student of the seminary and still be a moral reprobate. See, the problem is not knowledge. Like Jesus said in Matthew chapter 23, when he was talking about the Pharisees, he says, now, I better look it up. Matthew 23, verses 1 and 2. He says, the scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe. In other words, they give good advice. But do not do according to their deeds, for they say things and do not do them. And so this is the problem with the Pharisee. And a Pharisee, basically, his problem was hypocrisy, wasn't it? And so we need to be careful that we do not think that we achieve character just by learning more things, or that we do not impart character just by teaching people more about the Bible and giving them bigger and better Bible studies. That's not going to do it. Because, as a matter of fact, sometimes knowledge can hurt you more than it helps you. Maybe we could say that the distance between what you claim to know and what you do measures the size of your hypocrisy. Isn't that right? Now, what about Jesus? How did Jesus go about producing people where there was no gap between what they knew and what they were? And if we can discover how Jesus did it, maybe we can learn something about how we do it. And the first thing we realize is that Jesus was very parsimonious about his teachings. He just, he didn't tell anybody anything that they weren't ready to hear. And so, you know, the multitudes, they got nice little stories which they didn't understand. And he said, that's why I tell them nice little stories, so that they won't understand. Because I don't want them to understand right now.
Yeah, well, then he would get his disciples, now not the 12, but the disciples. He would get the disciples together, and he'd say, now, unto you it is given to know the things of the Spirit of God, the mysteries. And he would teach them more things. But then, even with the 12, the guys that were really in there, he was very careful about what he gave them and when. Let me show you some verses in John chapter 16. In verse 12, he says, and this is the last week. He'd been with them for 3.5 years. And in 3.5 years, if you haven't gotten around to saying it yet, then, you know, you're probably never going to say it. You'd think. But Jesus said, I have many more things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. Now, that's a key statement. You know, there are a lot of things that I would like to teach you. There are things that you need to learn, but you can't bear them right now. When is a person ready to bear a truth? Huh? Then he goes on, verse 13, he says, but when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth, for he will not speak of his own initiative. Whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will disclose to you what is to come. And so he says, now I'm just going to have to leave some things undone, simply because you're not able to take it now, and I'd rather not give it to you at all than give it to you in such a way that you're not able to bear. Now, we think when we get a guy, we want to help him, get him to grow, just, you know, back up the truck and dump it on him. You know, if a little bit of knowledge helps, then a whole lot will just transform his life. And so, boom, you know, off it comes, off the truck. And there he lays, pinned to the ground. Then he goes on, in verse 25, he says, "These things have I spoken to you in figurative language." He says, "Now I admit that I haven't been clear. It's a policy of mine not to be clear when I talk to you. And when I, an hour is coming when I will speak no more to you in figurative language, but will tell you plainly of the Father." And then in verse 29, his disciple says, "Lo, you are speaking plainly." Hey, something new. We're understanding him. How about that? You're not using figure of speech. "Now we know that you know all things and have no need for anyone to question you. By this we believe that you came from God." Can you imagine that? In the last week of his life with his disciples, he says, "There's a lot I'm not going to tell you. I'm just holding it, saving it." And then he says, "Now I'm going to tell you a few things that I've been kind of telling you in figure so that you wouldn't understand, but now I'm going to let you understand a little bit." And so he told them, "Ah, we understand now." And then he went on. So it's very obvious that Jesus was very careful to measure out what he gave people and when he gave them. Timing was of essence. Now, there are two philosophies of training. One, we could call it a structured approach. And the other is a non-structured approach. Now, a structured trainer is one who has it all figured out and decides who gets what and when. Kind of everybody gets the same. It's on everything. You see? And so the discipling of people and training of men is not a matter of just giving a person a curriculum of spiritual truths and saying, "Now you're trained." But it's related to meeting the person's needs as they arise. I think probably the most beautiful illustration of this was Jesus and Peter. And in John chapter 21, the last chapter in the book of John, Jesus, of course, had been crucified, had risen again, and the disciples were really bewildered by this time. Because like in Luke, it says they were walking along, and it's kind of like Linus and the Great Pumpkin, you know. They said, "Well, we had hoped that this Jesus would have been the Messiah, but now it's 3 days, and, you know, nothing has happened." And they were victims of an illusion. And so everybody was confused. And so Peter, you know, he says, "Well, when in doubt, go fishing." John 21, verse 3. Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." You know, that's interesting. It shows something about Peter. The other said, "We'll come along with you." Who was the achiever in the crowd? Peter. He was always the guy that, you know, made the first move, made the decisions. As a matter of fact, that was his problem. You know, Peter the lip. Always saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, turning right when he's supposed to turn left, you know, comes to first base and turns right. Well, so Peter says, "I'm going fishing." So they went along. They went out and got in the boat. That night they caught nothing. Well, then along came Jesus. The day was just breaking, and Jesus stood on the beach, and they couldn't see that it was Jesus. It was just dawn. And somebody with a little bit better eyesight than Peter says, "Hey, that's Jesus." And as verse 7. Well, in between there, Jesus said, "Have you caught anything?" "No." "Well, throw the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you'll find a catch." And they did, and that probably helped them with their eyesight a little bit. They cast the net on the right-hand side, and they couldn't even haul it in because of the fish. And then when they discovered it was Jesus, what happened? Who got out of the boat and went to Jesus? Peter. So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on and threw himself into the sea. And the others came in, you know, dragging the fish and the boat and all the work. But, you know, Peter was there just, you know, having a fat time with Jesus. Well, then they got up to the shore, and then Peter chipped in and did his share again. You know, he went out and he dragged the net in. And so you see that the temperament of the man, impulsive, aggressive, dynamic. And it's interesting, but this is at the tail end of Jesus' human involvement with Peter. And you see that Peter was still intact. See, Jesus had not spoiled Peter. He was still intact. So often when we train people, they don't bug us anymore. We've shaped them up, but they don't bug anybody anymore. We've taken the spirit out of them. But Jesus managed to not do that. But it was a very brutal process. Because we'll get into what happened as we go along here. So finally, Jesus fed them. And then he turned to Peter when he finished breakfast, verse 15. And he said to Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Now the word love here is agape. I know two words in Greek, agape and phileo, two words for love. And we're using them right here now. So he says, "Do you agape me?" Which is the highest form of love. It's the selfless kind of love that we find in the highest relationships. Our relationship with God can be our relationship with our wives and so on. He says, "Do you agape me more than these?" And Peter says, "Yes, Lord, you know that..." Then the word phileo comes in here. "Yes, Lord, you know that I'm your friend." He didn't answer Jesus with the same word. And then Jesus said, "Tend my lambs." And then he said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you agape me?" And Peter said, "Yes, Lord, you know that we're friends. I can't bring myself to say that I agape you. But I can certainly say that I phileo you. That at least we're friends, Jesus." And then Jesus said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, are we even friends?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, are we even friends? And he said, "Lord, you know all things. Look through me. Tell me if we're friends." What happened to the brash, cocky Peter? Well, something very profound had happened to him. Because Peter had the distinction of being reproved like no other man had ever been reproved. Remember in Matthew 16 where he'd just gotten an A on the quiz, you know, "Who are you? Who am I?" "Oh, you're the Christ, the Son of God." "Great, Peter." And then he went on and says, "Now, Peter, and fellows, I am going to suffer and die." And then Peter funked the lab test. He said, "Lord, no, never. We can't let that happen. We'll defend you." And then Jesus, what did he say? He said, "Get behind me, Satan. For you do not understand the things of God." What a blow. And just a couple of chapters later, Peter has another distinction of being reproved by God himself. He didn't learn from his reproof from Jesus because reproofs don't do it by themselves. And so they're up on the Mountain of Transfiguration. And there was, you know, Elijah. And who was the other one? I forgot. Moses, yeah. And then there was Jesus. Jesus was transfigured. It was kind of an awkward situation. Nobody kind of knew what to do with their hands or anything. And so Peter says, "Well, let's build three tabernacles. That's a good idea. While we're standing here, let's build three tabernacles." And Jesus said, and then God said, the Father says, "This is my beloved Son. Hear him." So Peter really got it from unusual sources. But he still didn't learn it. That's not enough to change a man's character. So then, in Mark 14, Jesus is telling the disciples that they're gonna deny him. verse 27, Jesus said to them, "You'll all fall away, because it's even prophesied that you will. But after I've been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Then Peter said to him, "Look, these other 11, I don't know about them. They probably will. But Master, you can count on me. Even though all may fall away, yet I will not." And Jesus said to him, "Truly I say to you, that you yourself this very night, before a cock crow twice, you shall three times deny me." But Peter insisted, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And they were all saying the same thing. See, Peter, right up to the time of death, had not learned to keep his big mouth shut. And up to the time of Jesus' death, he was still self-confident, trusting in the flesh, Simon Peter. And then you know the story, how Jesus was led to be judged. And there was Peter, kind of sitting out, standing out, warming himself by the fire. And three times they asked him if he were not one with Jesus, had not been with Jesus. And Peter swore and says, "No, I don't know the man." And just then, the cock crew. And then you know what Jesus did? In the midst of being judged, ready to be crucified, Jesus, always the trainer of men, thinking not of what he was going into, but thinking of Peter, he turned and he looked at Peter. How do you suppose Peter felt? Ah. And then here in John 21, they pick up the conversation as if nothing had happened. He said, "Peter, do you really love me more than these 11? Or these 10 now? These others that you think will deny me while you don't? Do you really love me more than these?" And Peter says, "Well, I'm your friend, Jesus." Peter went through the cure of fire. And then all of a sudden, Jesus says, "Feed my sheep." Now, what in the world does feeding the sheep have to do with what's going on? Three times he says, "Feed my sheep." Why is he talking about sheep there? Well, because it was sheep that Jesus always had on his mind. He wanted to tell Peter that in Mark 3:14 when he first chose him. But he knew that if he told Peter about the sheep before Peter was really ready to listen, Peter would have said, "Don't worry about a thing, boss. We'll take care of those sheep. Don't you just go ahead and go away, and we'll take care of those sheep. Just, you know, no problem." And Peter would not really have heard Jesus. Did Peter get the message? In his first letter that he ever wrote, that's recorded, what do you read there in chapter 5? "The sheep. Take care of the sheep. Feed the sheep. Don't you forget those sheep." He had gotten the message. It had burned into his brain because he was a ready listener at that time when his self-confidence was gone. Somehow Jesus had managed to take a man like that and preserve what was good in him and remove what was bad. That is the touch of a master. And how do we do that? Well, it's not easy. The fact is that we don't do it. We do not impart character. Only God imparts character. But we can collaborate with God in the accomplishment of this purpose. And I'd like to give you three observations about how to work with people in such a way that we indeed impart character. The first one is this. Know what you want to accomplish. See, right from the start, Jesus knew that he wanted to make a shepherd out of Peter. And so he was always working toward that end. A little opportunity opened itself, and Peter moved in, Jesus moved in. But he finished the objective by the time he was through with Peter. Well, I remember when I first started working with people, I'd lead a guy to Christ or start working with some fellow that wanted to get some help, and I didn't know I didn't know what I was doing. And I was afraid that they'd show up. So I'd have to work, help them. And it was kind of like a Chinese fire drill. You know, everybody was going in all directions all at once, and nobody really knew what was going on. And it was just chaos. And so, you know, I'd try to help people. There'd be no progress, and they'd fall off and die. And it was just kind of a bad scene. Well, then I ran across 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 10. And it says, according to the grace of God which is given to me, as a wise master builder, I laid a foundation. And another is building upon it. Let each man be careful how he builds upon it. And I realized that I certainly was no master builder. I didn't know the foundation from the roof. And so I felt the need to just figure out what I wanted to accomplish, what my objectives were in working with a person. So I ran across the idea of coming up with a list of objectives and things that I wanted to accomplish, or rather principles that I wanted to see built into the person's life. For instance, the centrality of Christ in his life, relationship of dependence on Christ, the place of the Holy Spirit in his life, the authority of the Scriptures over his life, and how to master the Scriptures, and things like the place of the promises in a person's life, how to pray, things like how to gear in with other Christians, how to communicate your faith, giving your testimony, things like that. But I felt that I needed to keep it down to a list of 20 things or so, and then really work on those. Otherwise, it'd just be an endless thing. And, you know, I've been working on that list since 1957. I'm still working on it. Improving it, modifying it, editing it, changing it a little bit, but always keeping it down to about that size. But then I found about four other guys who had the same problem, wanting to work with men, but not really knowing how to go about it. So we decided, okay, let's get together and use kind of the stimulus of the group, and let's just corner this thing once and for all. And so it was Herb Schlossberg, Denny Repko, and Sletten, Dave Sletten, and me, four of us. And we got together once a week, and we would take one of these subjects, and beforehand we would prepare maybe 9 or 10 hours in that subject, going through the Bible, finding everything we could in the Bible on the subject, and doing a topical study on it. And then we get together. Well, you know, there's a combined 40 hours of preparation among four guys, and it would take us 3 or 4 hours just to share and come up with what we'd learned. And it was a very high-powered situation, and, you know, 20 subjects. It took us less than a year, of course, to go through the whole thing. And when I was through, I really had a sense of confidence, because I knew when I was working with a guy that I could get from here to there, and I knew that what I would be giving him would be basically scriptural. And so I had a sense of direction. We made progress. And people kept dying on me. It wasn't enough. Something else was lacking. And what was lacking, I can illustrate it with an experience that we went through. In 1958, I inherited the Navigator work in Minneapolis, through a weird set of circumstances. They don't do things like that anymore. They've learned. But Bob Glockner was the area rep, single. And so he was 31 years old, something like that, and single, and he was going to get married. And he had one problem. He had 6 men living with him. And you don't bring a bride into a house with 7 men. So he had to do something with these 6 men. Well, Marge and I had been married for 4.5 years. And so Bob says, well, would you take these 6 guys? So we had a little house you could put in the corner of this auditorium. And we said, well, we'll have to move. Well, that's okay. So we went down and we rented an enormous house. What was it, 3 stories plus a basement? And put those 6 men in them. I'd never laid eyes on them before in my life. Didn't even know them. And I'd never run a nav home. I'd never been around the navigators very much, as a matter of fact. And there I was, you know, running a nav home. So I tried to figure out what nav home leaders do. And so I learned, you know, I kind of checked around and asked a few questions and things. I found that, you know, nav home leaders, they have Bible studies in their home, of course, and they there's a certain level of discipline and so on. And so I figured it out, and then we did all that. You know, like breakfast, what time was it, honey? 6 o'clock in the morning? 6:15 in the morning. We had breakfast every morning, 6:15, you know, that's, you know, austere, and that's good for you. And then, you know, at meal times, we'd check out verses, and every guy had an area of the home that he kept clean. You know, one fellow keep the living room, dining room, another fellow keep the yard, another fellow keep the bathroom, another one work in the kitchen. After meals, you know, everybody get up and you know, put everything in its place and clean up the kitchen. And, you know, it was, you know, all very squared away. And so, you know, we reproved each other when we felt something was wrong. And I met man-to-man with the guys, you know, an hour a week. And we'd, you know, go through the Bible studies and so on. And then we had home night where we'd study the Bible and pray and discuss things together. And so it was, we were doing the whole nine yards. But you know, those guys were strangers when they came into that house. And they were strangers when they left. It was strangers in, strangers out. You know why? Because I was concerned about being a nav home leader. And so I was wearing the image of a nav home leader. And so I was running around with this image out here all the time, you know, nav home leader. And the fellows, of course, had to do the same thing. You know, they duly put on their nav home dweller images. And so it was a year-long masquerade. There I was, you know, dressed in my nav home leader image, and there they were, dressed in their nav home dweller images, and we never met as people. And the first clue I got of that was when one of the guys, Dewey Johnson, says, you know, he says, you don't love us. And he was right. I was treating those guys as projects. See, and I wasn't free to love them because I was so concerned about my own image. First Corinthians 1:9 says, we're called unto the fellowship of his dear son. Fellowship is having all things in common. In Portuguese, it's called comunhão, or everything in common. Having all things in common. And then in 1 John 1:7, it says a very strange thing. It says, if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, we have fellowship, not with God, as you'd think that verse would say. But it says, if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another. Now, what in the world does my walking in the light, or walking in a relationship with God, spending time in being, having all things in common with God, what does that have to do with whether I can relate to you or not? Well, it has everything in the world to do with whether I can relate to you or not. If I am not rightly relating to God, I cannot relate to you. I can't even relate to myself. Because in the presence of God, the voice of God is heard, and he tells me what I really am. Light exposes, doesn't it? When I stand in the light of the presence of God, I see me as I am. Like in John 3:19, it says that you know, the unbeliever doesn't want to come to the light because he doesn't want to have his deeds made known. But it says, everyone that does evil hates the light and does not come to the light. But he who practices the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest as having been wrought in God. And so I come to the light. because I want to know what I'm really like, even though it's never pleasant. But when I stand in the presence of God, I see myself as I really am. And then I think, well, what's the use? If that's the way I really am, then I'll let Him know it too. And I can open my life to the person around me and let him see me as I am. You know, I think Paul is a good illustration of this. When I first began to read Paul, I used to think, man, he's a stuffed shirt. You know, he's so proud. Going on bragging all the time. When you get into the last part of 2 Corinthians, you can hardly stand it. You think, man, you know, is there no end to his ego? But then as I read on, I began to realize that I wasn't understanding the man. Because these are some of the things he'd say. I was with you in weakness. This is 1 Corinthians 2. And in fear, and in much trembling. And my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words. And all of a sudden you find that Paul also talks about his weaknesses. Another place he says in 2 Corinthians, I think it's chapter 10, my critics say that I have no presence. You know, it's like if there are 50 people in a room, and you come walking in, and someone says, hey, the Apostle Paul is here. Oh, yeah? Where? Let me guess. And so you see this, you know, big, beautiful dude over here, and you think, man, that must be Paul. No. Well, what about that sophisticated old gentleman over there? No. Well, you know, this guy looks pretty intellectual. That must be Paul. No. And you go through all 49, and there's this one skinny, little, shriveled up bird over here, and you think, well, it can't be him. That's him. Paul says, yeah, you know, there's nothing imposing about me. In another place he says, now I know that I'm no speaker, but I do have knowledge. In another place he says, we were scared stiff. We were scared out of our wits. We despaired even of life. Now, if it hadn't been that the old Apostle Paul was there, and if I hadn't said, never fear, you know, I am here, why, all those guys would have panicked. And he says, no. He says, I, along with the others, we were just scared stiff. Paul was frank about his weaknesses. He was transparent. And because he could be transparent and frank about his weaknesses without embarrassment or shame, he could also be candid about his strengths without pride. In other words, when people met Paul, they met a real man, not somebody playing games. I told one of you here about a friend of mine who is a missionary, brought up in the Hitler Youth. And he was trained in the Hitler Youth to be stoic. That stoicism is a virtue. And so his wife told me that in their 14 years of marriage, he never admitted to being hungry, tired, or not feeling well. How do you relate to that? You can't. You don't meet a person when you meet someone like that. It's not real. You know, that's not your experience. You just can't identify with him. And this fellow came to me and wanted help in learning how to make disciples when I discovered what his problems were. I backed off and didn't help him because we lived in different towns. He'd need therapy to be able to rightly relate to a person and help him. And the fruit of his life shows it. So often we think that being a good testimony, we do most absurd things in the name of being a good testimony. We go around with this resurrected Christian mask on our faces. And we think that if we let any weaknesses show, any doubts, any fears, any resentment against God or against anybody else, that we're going to ruin our testimony. That is absolutely the opposite of the truth. Because when we take the mask off, instead of being a resurrected Christian, you know, already perfect, you know what we really are? Forgiven sinners. In the present tense, we are being forgiven every day. And if people can see that that's what we are, then we can communicate. They can identify with that. So, I've told you just two things. One, to know where you're going, figure out your objectives with a person, what principles you want to transmit, and the second one, be transparent. Be an open person. And the third and last one is be attentive to his needs. So often what we do is we give a person what we're high on at the moment. Now, sometimes that helps and sometimes it doesn't. So we give a person what we know how to do, what we're ready to give him. You know, ready or not, here I come. Wham! And that we call training. But I've put together five questions which help me in being attentive to the needs of the men that I'm ministering to. And what I do with these questions is once a month, I get away and I pray over the men. And often I do it with a buddy, another fellow that's co-laboring with me, because two heads are better than one in a situation like this. Better objectivity. And so I pray over the men one by one, and I ask these five questions in the presence of God. And the answers to these five questions help me determine what to do with him next. The five questions are, one, where is he now? How's he doing? Where is he now? Second one, what does he need? Man, you may be able to make a list half a yard long of things he needs. Then the third question, what is he ready for? Just because you can see the need doesn't mean he's ready for it. So he asks, now what's he ready for? What can he handle now? And then the fourth, what is most urgent? Because it could be that he's ready for three or four things. But usually there's one thing that's hanging him up and keeping that person from growing. What is most urgent? And then the fifth question, how do we get to this? How am I going to help him with this? And those answers could be varied, of course. So those three things. Now what this does, if you approach the ministering to people from this angle, it gives you versatility. And you'll find that you can minister to just about anybody who walks, rather than just those people that groove on your little structure. Now any structured system will find people who respond to it. And that's good. But it's inclusive and it's exclusive. It will include certain people, but it will exclude others just because it's not their bag. I'm working with two fellows here in town. One is a Russian. He's born in Belgium. And the other one is an American. And this Russian, his background is typically Russian in that he was very atheistic. And took him a long time to become a Christian. Quite intellectual. And a very rewarding person to have around. He's just one of these people that just enriches you when you're with him. And so he was... I've been traveling a lot, and so it's been tough to be faithful to a guy. And so while I was gone one time, I said, well, why don't you get in with this group of new Christians over here? There's a study there here in town. And so I sent him over there for 3 weeks while I was gone. And I came back and I says, well, how's it going? And he says, oh man, he says, I got to get out of there. I can't stand it. Well, why? Well, he says, I ask a question and they give me a chapter and a verse as if that answered it. Well, someone will say, yeah, he's having a problem with the inspiration of the scriptures. Nothing abnormal. You know, He didn't have it settled what the scriptures were, and it takes time. You can't ask a guy, insist that a guy accept the scriptures until the scriptures have a chance to defend themselves in his life. So I pulled him out of there, and I said, okay, I think that you could really master the scriptures. Now, how do you go about it? And he wants to master the scriptures. So I said, how do you go about it? And he said, well, I don't know. I said, how do you think? Well, I don't know. Well, what's the scientific process? Well, hypothesis, research, and conclusion. I said, okay, all that is just a question and an answer, isn't it? Yeah. So I said, okay, now let's study the Bible. Let's go to Colossians. And you ask all the questions you can and find any answers you can, but don't worry about the answers you can't find. Well, the guy is just scarfing up the book of Colossians and growing like crazy. Well, on the other hand, this other fellow, Jim, we began to study, and I thought, well, I haven't done this for years. I'm going to try it. So I gave him the first Bible study book of the Navigators. And I says, okay, why don't you do this? And next time we get together, we'll go into it. And so during the week, while between meetings, I prepared a chapter in the book and was ready to meet him. He came back, and he says, man, he says, why didn't you give me the rest of those books? He says, I ran out of material on the second day. And he opened up his book, and he had the whole book done. He says, well, for the rest of the days, I just kept going back over and trying to memorize all the verses and all the questions. And so, see, Oleg, the first guy, had tried those books, and it just totally turned him off. And Jim, the second guy, got a hold of those same books, same material, and is just feeding his soul like crazy. But you see, if he has some options, you can handle the Olegs and the Jims. But if you only have one little deal and say, okay, get in my deal or get off, then you're going to miss some of the greatest people in the world.